of rice or one pot of food, and they are struggling to get some of that to bring back to their families. When you see small children staying unaccompanied because they lost the whole family, when you see one man who buried his whole family and who's walking down the street like losing his mind because he lost all that he dreamt would grow up with him, which is his children, he lost his wife, he lost his father, he lost his mother, he lost his house, he lost any hope in life that he can clutch to. I saw many people talking to themselves down the streets. I saw many people crying because they have no one to cry to. They have no shoulder to cry over. They have no one to look after them. They have no one to console them. They have no one even to offer them some kind word to look after them. And they are going to, and they're driven insane because of that. Situation is inconceivable. It has affected all aspects of life of Gazans, and it continues to affect them, and it has destroyed many lives, and it continues to destroy life, and it is likely to destroy any hope that Gaza would survive. And I think this is the plan to break Gaza and to make Gaza uninhabitable and to destroy any possibility for Gazans to relive or to rebuild or to just retake their life again.
Gaza now has the highest percentage of people facing acute food insecurity anywhere in the world. Finally, Akram Al-Sahri, as we watch you on the ground there in Rafah, and we thank you and your cameraman, we understand the very serious risks you face. I'm wondering if you question whether even to wear the vest you are wearing that says press, in light of the latest news just this week, bringing to possibly over 120 the number of Gaza-based journalists killed. The Israeli drone struck a pair of Al Jazeera journalists on Tuesday, seriously injuring correspondent Ismail Abu Omar. He's had his leg amputated, and his cameraman Ahmad Matar. They're in European hospital. Then you have yesterday Palestinian journalist Mutaz al-Ghafari killed in Gaza City in an Israeli airstrike that also killed his wife and his child. Did you know these reporters? How are you protecting yourself?
Well, as a matter of fact, Ahmad Matar is a friend of mine. The last time I shook hands with him was 3 days ago. He shook my hand, but unfortunately he has no hand now because his hand and his arm was amputated and he's struggling for his life right now. He's one of my neighbors. He's one of my friends. I know him very well. He's such a very nice and kind person. I know also the Ismail Abu Omar, the one who's struggling for his life now because of unexpected hemorrhage because of his injury. I know many other journalists who were targeted and killed because of the Israeli ongoing bombardment. I know they have lives, I know they have families, I know they have careers that should be protected according to Geneva Conventions, and I know they were targeted and killed despite the fact that they are protected. And I know also that it's not only the journalists who were killed, there are also some humanitarian aid people who were killed. There were also some UNRWA people who were working to serve the population that is displaced, and they were killed also. I know many other people who were caring for other people, and they ended up being killed. The killing is massive. The killing is thorough. And I think no one in Gaza is protected, no safe haven. And I think there is every single person in Gaza now lacks that sense of safety and security. And we all understand that we are going to be suspended, killed people. And we know it's just a matter of time when Israel would reach any one of us and would kill any one of us, either our dears or ourselves or our families or our friends or our acquaintances. This is the situation. It is as dire as it sounds, but it's different when it's felt. It's different when it's about the people you know. It's different when about the people you love. It's different when about the people who shake their hands, shake your hands, smile at your face, say good morning or good afternoon or even good night. It's the personal stories of the people that makes us sometimes at the verge of collapse and breaking, but we understand that we have a mission to fulfill, which is to communicate the voice of the voiceless in Gaza, which is to show the real suffering the people have been enduring without no guilt that have been committed by them. It's a story of a whole population. It's not just Ismail or Ahmed. It's not just Akram or any other one. It's a story of a whole nation that has been under considerable fear and horror because of indiscriminate fire, and it's the duty of the world to continue to work towards ceasing the fire and ending this atrocity now, because I think the consciousness of the world has been stained by the ongoing atrocities, and I think the ones who were killed, the ones who are guiltless, the ones who were hoping that they would survive and build their life and continue growing and loving their friends and ended up killing, I think they deserve a fitting homage, which is serving justice and ending this ongoing aggression and enhancing and bringing about a ceasefire.
Akram al-Sathari, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I can't believe what we are talking about now is you risking your life to bring us this report. Akram is a Gaza-based journalist joining us from Rafah in southern Gaza. Next up, we speak with the former head of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth. Stay with us. Haitham Safia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
South Africa has urged the International Court of Justice to take action if Israel goes ahead with its planned ground invasion of Rafah. In a statement, the South African government said it's concerned Israel's actions in Rafah will result in, quote, further large-scale killing, harm and destruction, and breach the Genocide Convention. This is South Africa's International Relations Minister, Naledi Pandor, speaking Wednesday outside the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
South Africa is totally horrified at what is happening, continuing to happen to the people of Gaza and the West Bank and now Rafah. We believe this confirms the allegation we've tabled before the ICJ that genocide is underway in the Palestinian territories, in the occupied territories, and clearly the actions of the Israeli government prove that what we have said is actually accurate.
For more, we're joined in Geneva, Switzerland, by Ken Roth, visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly three decades as the executive director of Human Rights Watch. Ken, welcome back to Democracy Now! We just heard this devastating report on the ground from a journalist in Rafah, in Gaza. And then we hear the South African Foreign Affairs Minister talking about the renewed appeal they're making to the International Court of Justice. Can you explain what's happening and what this imminent ground invasion, if that's what's about to happen in Rafah, means, and if you think international law can deal with this?
Well, Amy, I think as everybody knows, the Israeli military has gradually been moving from northern to southern Gaza. And the last place left, the supposed safe place, where at this point, as we've heard, 1.2 million Palestinians have congregated, is Rafah. There's no place else to go within Gaza. And, you know, not surprisingly, there undoubtedly are some Hamas people there too. And so Netanyahu is saying, we want to invade Rafah. Now, there's this problem. There would be massive bloodshed if that happened. So even the Biden administration is saying, don't do it until you evacuate the civilian population. Now, Netanyahu has said, yes, I'll evacuate, but there have been no plans whatsoever. And indeed, if you listen to the far-right ministers in his cabinet, people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, you know, people whose votes Netanyahu depends on to stay in power and to stay out of prison on corruption charges, they're saying the only evacuation that they want is into Egypt, out of Gaza, a forced deportation, probably another Nakba, with little prospect that anybody who leaves Gaza would get to come back. And so that's the stake. Everybody's telling Netanyahu, move people someplace else within Gaza, but there's no place else that's safe. Netanyahu's determined to move forward because he needs to keep this war going. Once the war ends, his political reckoning for the intelligence failure of October 7th starts, and he's likely to be out of a job. And we're sort of in this dilemma. Now, the International Court of Justice could intervene. The order that it issued last month had basically three elements to it. One was, you know, take far greater care not to kill civilians. Two was to allow in humanitarian aid. And three was for Israeli government officials to stop their incitement of genocide. And as far as we can tell, it was only the statements that have stopped. The aid has not come in any greater amount. The killing doesn't seem to have stopped. And so, in any event, Israel has to report back to the International Court of Justice on February 23rd. I have no idea what they're going to say, because they basically have just, like, ignored the order. But now there's a possibility that even before the 23rd, the court will hear this emergency application from South Africa. And I think it's worth noting that in the original case, South Africa, you know, sought a ceasefire. But I never thought that was in the cards, because only the Israeli government, only states, frankly, are before the International Court of Justice. Hamas wasn't there, so the court wasn't going to order a ceasefire of just one side. But Rafah is different, because there's not a lot of fighting by Hamas from Rafah, but rather this is just a proposed invasion by Israeli forces. And it is conceivable that the International Court of Justice would order a halt to that. That, of course, begs the question, who enforces that? The UN Security Council has that power, but that requires contending with the U.S. veto, contending with Biden. The person who, frankly, does have the most power to stop all of this bloodshed is Joe Biden. But so far, while he's been outspoken, he's not been willing to put any teeth in his words. Most significantly, he's not been willing to stop or even to condition the $3.8 billion in annual U.S. military aid or the massive arms sales to Israel. Those are the kinds of steps that, if taken, Netanyahu would be forced to listen to. But so far, Biden's words are just empty, and Netanyahu ignores them.
Ken Roth, if you could say a little bit more about this enforcement or lack of enforcement mechanism of the International Court of Justice. You wrote a piece last month in The Guardian suggesting that the political pressure, despite the lack of enforcement mechanism, that the political pressure on Israel would be such that they would have to, in some sense, comply. So a couple of questions. First, what would happen, for instance, February 23rd, as you said, Israel is supposed to report back? Is it possible that they do not report back? And then the International Criminal Court, which takes, of course, individuals to court. Who are the people? You've just mentioned senior Israeli officials Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. Who are the people that the ICC could prosecute? And your response to what Karim Khan so far has said?
Well, in terms of, you know, what is the pressure on Israel, I think it can be broken down into three elements. You know, one is just the, you know, the utter embarrassment of having been found to be plausibly committing genocide. That's what the court found. Now, most governments, that would be sufficient to, you know, force them to step back. But this is Netanyahu. And you know, as I mentioned, Netanyahu's political future and, frankly, his personal liberty are at stake. And Netanyahu has always prioritized himself. And so ending the war means, you know, this political reckoning, this investigation into what happened, what intelligence failure allowed October 7th to take place. He doesn't want that to go forward, so he keeps fighting and fighting, hoping somehow to survive, somehow to stay out of prison. So the shaming isn't working. The economic pressure that Joe Biden could exert on Israel would be very powerful. You know, to stop the billions of U.S. military aid, to stop the arms sales, that would be incredibly powerful as a statement. Joe Biden is nowhere near that. He's, you know, speaking nice words. He's saying, take greater care for civilians, let in more humanitarian aid, don't invade Rafah without an evacuation plan. But there's nothing backing that up. And Netanyahu basically is just, you know, thumbing his nose at Joe Biden because there's no clout behind these nice words. Now, the final, you know, source of pressure, which you mentioned, is the International Criminal Court. And for viewers, just to make clear, there are two tribunals in The Hague, just to confuse people. You know, one is the International Court of Justice, which is a civil tribunal that hears complaints between states. That's where South Africa brought its genocide case. That's the court that made the ruling that Israel is plausibly committing genocide and issued the three basic orders that I outlined. The separate tribunal is the International Criminal Court. This is, as the name implies, is a criminal court. It prosecutes individuals, not governments. It tends to focus on the most senior responsible officials. And that means it's going to look at the chain of command. And it's quite clear that in this case, the orders with respect to, you know, dropping these 2,000-pound bombs that are causing such devastation in Gaza, the orders to allow in only drips and drabs of humanitarian or medical aid, you know, these are orders that are coming from the top. So I think the people who are most vulnerable would be Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, and Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. Now, is Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor, going to act? We don't know. You know, he has had an open investigation into what's called the Palestine case since he took office in January 2021. But he has gone very, very slowly. And so far, all we've gotten from him is a couple of nice, eloquent statements before the media. One on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border, another from Ramallah, the capital of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And so, you know, he's a barrister, he's very eloquent, these are nice statements, but nothing else. So we're all waiting for the war crimes charges. Clearly Hamas is going to be charged. You know, what it did on October 7th is horrendous. You know, killing civilians, abducting civilians, blatant war crimes. So, you know, Hamas leadership is very vulnerable. I don't see Karim Khan only charging Hamas, given 28,000 Palestinian deaths in Gaza, given the pervasive starvation in Gaza. So he's going to have to look at both sides, and he's not moving quickly. If he were to move quickly, that would wake people up. You know, if Netanyahu suddenly faced war crimes charges, that would be a very different factor in the calculation that leads him to keep killing and besieging Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
In terms of crimes against humanity, the cutting of aid to UNRWA, the U.S., the largest contributor to the UN Palestine Relief Agency. Can you talk about the significance of this and the Senate bill that was passed by Democrats and Republicans, not only giving $14 billion, much of it in military aid to Israel, but cutting aid to UNRWA that runs the hospitals, the schools, to millions of Palestinians in Gaza and in other places as well, Ken, and Israel particularly targeting hospitals?
Well, Amy, as you note, the treatment of UNRWA has been absolutely despicable. The Israeli government claims, they haven't put forth evidence, but they claim that 12 UNRWA employees out of 12,000 in Gaza, that 12 took part in Hamas's October 7th attack. We don't know whether that was true or not, but UNRWA did everything that Israel conceivably could have imagined. It fired the staff members who were still on the staff. A couple of them had apparently died already. It immediately launched an investigation. It did everything you would want. But Israel's attack on UNRWA is really not about those 12 staff members. Israel has wanted to get rid of UNRWA forever. Now, this was, I think, accentuated by the fact that the International Court of Justice actually relied repeatedly on descriptions by UNRWA of the awful reality in Gaza, the utter lack of humanitarian aid, the starvation, the attacks on hospitals and the like. But Israel hates UNRWA because it believes that UNRWA is responsible for the Palestinian refugee problem. This is utterly naive. UNRWA is a humanitarian agency. It does, you know, as you noted, run schools and clinics, not only in Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but also in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, you know, wherever Palestinian refugees are. And the Israeli government view is if UNRWA were to disappear tomorrow, Palestinian refugees would somehow forget that they're Palestinian refugees. And this desire to return to their ancestral homes in Israel would just evaporate. Now, you know, this is a way of just whitewashing history. You know, suddenly we don't have to talk about 1948. We don't have to talk about the fact that there were, you know, 600,000 Palestinians who were forcibly displaced by Israeli forces and have never been permitted back to Israel. That just disappears. You know, that was the original sin, but we're going to forget about that. We're just going to get rid of UNRWA. Now, this is naive, but that is the Israeli government line. And what's particularly despicable is that Joe Biden fell for this and suspended aid to UNRWA, followed then by 18, 19 other governments around the world. And, you know, it would be one thing to believe this kind of propaganda, you know, in ordinary times. But this is in the middle of a war. This is in the middle of a situation where there is, by all accounts, widespread starvation in Gaza. There is impending famine for a significant part of the population. And UNRWA is the main vehicle to deliver what drips and drabs of aid get into Gaza. You know, now some of the governments like Germany said, oh, well, other groups can deliver the aid. But the other groups got together and issued a collective statement and said, there is no way we can even come close to replicating UNRWA staff. UNRWA alone has this capacity to deliver aid in the midst of this war. So if you devastate UNRWA, which is what this funding suspension does, UNRWA has said, you know, it will have to shut down by mid-March if the funds are not renewed. To get rid of UNRWA is to condemn the Palestinian population in Gaza to death by starvation. And that, we should be clear, that's what's going on right now, because Israel has this ideological vendetta against UNRWA in its hope that it can somehow disappear the Palestinian refugee problem.
Ken Roth, we're going to have to leave it there. Visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, served for nearly three decades as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Geneva, Switzerland. Next up, we go to Bill Hortung. As President Biden urges the House to vote on the Senate's foreign aid bill that includes $14 billion to Israel. Stay with us. Back in 20 seconds. Steeds of Light by the Stratospheres. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Here in the United States, President Biden is urging the House to vote to approve a $95 billion foreign aid bill passed by the Senate Tuesday that includes $14 billion for Israel's war on Gaza, along with $60 billion for Ukraine and $8 billion for Indo-Pacific allies like Taiwan. It also strips U.S. funding for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders opposed the measure, joined by two Democratic senators who broke ranks with their party, Jeff Merkley and Peter Welch. This is Welch.
I voted against the supplemental for one key reason. I cannot, in good conscience, support sending billions of additional taxpayer dollars for Prime Minister Netanyahu's military campaign in Gaza. It's a campaign that has killed and wounded a shocking number of civilians. It's created a massive humanitarian crisis with no end in sight. It's inflamed tensions in the Middle East, eroding support among Arab states that had been aligned with Israel. And of course, it has severely compromised any remaining hope, almost all remaining hope, for the two-state solution that we all know is ultimately essential for peace in the Middle East.
That's Vermont Senator Peter Welch. The foreign aid package now faces an uncertain future in the Republican-controlled House, where Speaker Mike Johnson's refusing to schedule a vote without first adding new anti-immigrant and border enforcement measures and may propose an alternative package today. For more, we are here in New York with William Hartung, national security foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His new piece for Forbes is headlined, Senate Aid Package Underscores Washington's Skewed Priorities. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Bill. Talk about what this bill represents, which is largely supported by Democrats.
Well, the first thing that stuck out to me is $95 billion, most of it to ship weapons overseas into war zones. You know, this Senate would never do an emergency bill to stop record homelessness, stop hunger, deal with the climate crisis. The United States has the worst record of life expectancy of any industrialized country, and yet we're putting the bulk of our resources into implements of war. And of course, to give Israel more money to continue the slaughter in Gaza that we've seen laid out in this program is obscene. And I think the members who voted for it should be ashamed of themselves. But I think the real point is to stop the killing. There's got to be a ceasefire. And President Biden, through cutting off, conditioning U.S. military aid, has the strongest hand to try to do that. So there's got to be more pressure. I know there's been a lot at the grassroots level, some within the government, but it's got to continue because I think the goal here has to be to stop the slaughter.
And the Senate vote came just hours after the EU's foreign policy chief urged the United States and other countries to stop providing arms to Israel. So if you could respond to that, how common is it, first of all, for the EU foreign policy chief to make such a pronouncement? And whether this kind of pressure will affect the Biden administration's policy?
Well, it's very unusual to see that kind of statement, from an ally. But this is a very unprecedented and devastating situation. So, I don't know what exactly is going to move the president. It's clear it's going to hurt him electorally. It's clear that it's running the risk of a wider Middle East war. There's really no, from a realistic point of view, there's no reason to be doing this. It's basically kind of a ideological kind of issue that seems to be embedded in the president's consciousness that has to be dislodged.
Bill Hartung, you've talked about how the Pentagon and military contractors are exploiting Russia's invasion of Ukraine to get special favors, to push arms out the door without proper vetting, building more factories without oversight. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, the industry has had this long-standing list of things they wanted, as you pointed out. Push arms quickly, less human rights vetting, more subsidies to build factories. And, of course, this reduced scrutiny will also make it easier for them to engage in price gouging. So they've sort of wrapped themselves in the flag with respect to Ukraine. The president has called them the arsenal of democracy, I think, which would be a surprise to the people of Yemen and other places where the U.S. is arming dictatorships. So they're trying to run with this and really change the whole argument about whether we should be spending more on the military at a time when the budget is soaring towards $1 trillion a year. U.S. accounts for 40% of world military spending, more than the next 15 countries combined. So there's got to be strong pushback against this because essentially it's kind of a new Cold War atmosphere and its attempt to kind of whitewash the negative consequences of what these companies do. And, of course, contractors get about half of that close to $1 trillion a year that we spend on the military.
Finally, if President Biden says he's warning Israel, for example, against a ground invasion of Rafah, but then increasing funding to Israel and military funding, what message is that sending?
Well, I think anything this administration says about human rights, the rule of law, the rules-based international order rings hollow in the face of what's happening with respect to supporting Israel in this war. And I think it'll reverberate well beyond this conflict. I think, the U.S. will not be taken as seriously when they raise these kinds of issues in the future. So not only is it horrific for the people of Gaza, but I think it undermines the role of the United States in the world in any cases where they actually would want to play a constructive role. So it's hard to manage a more damaging foreign policy decision.
William Hartung, we want to thank you so much for being with us, national security and foreign policy expert at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to your piece in Forbes, Senate aid package underscores Washington's skewed priorities. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh here in New York. This news is funded by viewers and listeners like you. Please support our work at democracynow.org/support.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.